This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Wednesday, July 28th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, Denver area janitors are celebrating a new tentative contract the Service Employees International Union describes as historic. What constitutes a livable wage in Colorado? That's a question a Colorado Sun reporter posed to her readers. We'll go through the responses. We'll also hear the latest in a collaborative series on the housing crisis in the Rocky Mountain region. And finally, our regular Wednesday feature, Naturally, with herbalist Brigitte Mars. A BBC update and commentary from Jim Hightower are at the bottom of the hour. And then it's a public affair. In the first half hour, Miriam Schiff speaks with Dr. Janine Danibal about collective trauma. Then Rosanna Longo better takes us on a farm visit to look at land restoration efforts. Then at 9:30, the Morning Sound Alternative comes your way. That's all still ahead this morning after these headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
People in the majority of counties in Colorado should start wearing masks in indoor public places, according to new guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The agency recommends that in areas where there is a higher substantial spread of COVID-19, the protective gear should be used. Substantial transmission is defined by the CDC as 50 or more infections per 100,000 people over the last week. Data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment shows that 41 of Colorado's 64 counties currently have at least that many cases. Included in those counties are Denver and Boulder and the rest of the Front Range. It also affects most of those in the western half of Colorado and some counties on the eastern plains. Recently, new coronavirus infections have increased in Colorado and hospitalizations are going up, even if more slowly than during previous surges. Colorado Governor Jared Polis declined to say whether he would consider reinstating a mask mandate. He pointed to increased vaccination as the best way forward. A spokesperson for the governor told 9 News that they are reviewing the CDC guidance. Currently, there's no plan to require masks in Denver. The Boulder Valley School District has announced it will determine its masking policy for the next school year at an August 10th board meeting. Meanwhile, new vaccinations against COVID-19 rose somewhat in the state during the week ended last Saturday, and the Denver Post reports it may be a sign that the 3-month-long decrease in shots could be starting to stabilize. Over 51,000 people received a vaccine last week in Colorado, an increase close to 4%. At least one hospital system with facilities in Colorado will require their employees to get vaccinated against COVID-19 by this fall. The Colorado Sun reports that Banner Health, which operates hospitals in Greeley, Fort Collins, Sterling, and Brush, announced that it will require employees to be vaccinated by November 1st, or they will be fired. No other hospitals in the state are currently imposing the same requirement. An Aurora police officer has been charged with felony assault for his conduct during an arrest last week. Officer John Hobart is accused of strangling, pistol whipping, and reportedly threatening to shoot an unarmed man on South Parker Road Friday afternoon. Body camera footage shows Officer Hobart repeatedly striking the head of Kyle Vinson with the butt of a pistol and squeezing Vinson's throat during almost 40 seconds. The man cried and begged for his life, according to an arrest affidavit. Another officer, Francine Martinez, has been charged because she failed to intervene in Officer Hobart's use of force. The incident arose out of a trespassing call during which the officers detained Vincent and two other men who were wanted on felony warrants. At a press conference yesterday, Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson condemned the action of the two officers, saying that she was disgusted and angry, adding that what occurred was not police work and was not acceptable. Preliminary maps for Colorado's new legislative redistricting have been drawn up and released by staff at the state capitol, and critics are saying that they are racially gerrymandered. The Independent Redistricting Commission held a hearing last night in Denver at which CBS4 reports that black and brown community leaders voiced their concerns. State Representative Leslie Herrod, a Democrat from Denver, says the new map split many communities of color, diluting their voting power. She said that the black vote in Five Points and North Park Hill is now divided between two districts, and the areas are different, very different, not only in racially, but also economically. Herrod said that black communities in Aurora see the same divisions as do several Latino neighborhoods. Representative Herod added that she is confident they will see new maps that reflect the vibrant diversity of the community and ensure its representation at the Capitol. In Denver, city officials presented the final project list for a proposed bond package, and there was criticism from at least one council member who said there had not been enough outreach. Colorado Politics reports that 80 infrastructure projects would be funded if the bond proposal is passed by voters in November. However, council member Candy Sita Baca said that people in neighborhoods in her district, like Elyria Swansea, have been asking for projects that benefit the people who live there. She added that her community is very concerned about the proposal by Mayor Michael Hancock to build an arena in that area. During the public outreach process, people who responded prioritized investing in housing and sheltering, but the bond plan only has two housing projects for over $37 million, less than one-fourth of the funds going towards the arena. There's an air quality alert again for today, and it will be sunny and hot with highs in the upper 90s and about the same for tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 90s under sunny skies. Right now it's 66 in Boulder, 70 in Fort Collins, and 75 in Denver. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Unionized janitors in Denver are celebrating a tentative agreement for a new three-year contract. Joining me to speak about the details is Juan Montaña of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, Local 105. Welcome to the program, Juan.
Hi, Shannon. Thank you for having me here.
The SEIU is describing the new agreement as historic. Why and how many workers does it cover?
The contract covers 2,400 janitors in the Denver-Boulder metro area. It is historic for many reasons. We have really great improvements to rights in the workplace, and we got really awesome wages.
Janitors have been among the less visible essential workers of the pandemic. Who makes up the janitorial workers within the ranks of SEIU Local 105?
Janitors are mostly Latino women, immigrant. There is janitors from all races and genders and ages, but most of our janitors are women, between 40 and older. They have their children, they have their grandchildren. Most of them come from Central America and Mexico.
There is much talk right now of a worker shortage, and specifically within service workers, like people who work in restaurants. Are you seeing that same type of worker shortage among janitorial staff?
We are seeing that it is harder to hire janitors right now because it's a very hard work. It is sort of invisible and you work long hours, you work at night, but also because our janitors are unionized, this is a much better work than other jobs. So a lot of the people who have been, were there before the pandemic, had stayed through because they have their seniority, they have their vacations, they have their rights, and that really, keeps them going. They are very committed to the buildings where they work.
Under this new agreement, how much does an entry-level janitor make per hour in Denver?
It depends where you are, but I can tell you that with this contract, every janitor in the Denver-Boulder metro area will reach $15 an hour.
Put this new agreement into a historical perspective. Denver was the birthplace of the Justice for Janitors campaign. What has been the arc of this labor movement from then to now?
Justice for Janitors started here in Denver. Then it kind of grew all over the country. One thing that is very important to recognize is that this win was only possible because janitors have a union in their workplace. Most people in our community, and really most people in the United States, they have to take what the boss gives them, especially if you're in the service work, in the service industry. But when you have a union, and everybody has the right to negotiate with their bosses, but in practice, that doesn't happen if you don't have a union. This is a historic contract for many reasons. If you look at the total package, at the total compensation for everybody together, is about $21.7 million. That's at least the calculation we have right now. What does this mean? This means that those $21.7 million are not going to corporations out of state. This money is staying here in Denver, and it's going to be spent in the babysitting, in fixing your car, in the store in the corner. So it's something where we all of us are going to benefit. The raises that we were able to achieve were the biggest raises that we have ever seen in Denver. And this is only fitting because Denver has become a world-class city. Denver real estate market is thriving, and it has for many years. And this was the time not just to adjust with the pandemic. This is a time also to adjust to the prosperity that's happening in Denver and make sure that that prosperity stays in this community.
Juan Montaña is with the Service Employees International Union, that's SEIU, Local 105. You are listening to The Morning Magazine. Joining me is Tamara Chung, tech, business, and economy reporter for the Colorado Sun. You put out a weekly column called What's Working, and in the most recent one, you tackled the issue of the labor shortage and living wages. And in doing so, you consulted readers across the state about what constitutes a living wage. What was the response?
Well, the response was pretty good. I put a poll in the column, and, you know, random people could respond. So it's very unscientific, but it depends on, you know, who sees it. And readers from all over, you know, from east, west, western slope, the eastern plains responded. And it was great because it's based on people's own experiences. And folks were allowed to provide a comment. And it really helps understand what's happening in different parts of the state.
What was the range of the responses specifically having to deal with the cost of living in different areas of the state?
Well, what I hear a lot from readers is, well, I can't work a minimum wage job because my rent is too high. So the idea of what is a livable wage has come up in many columns. So this time I just asked, hey, what is a livable wage? And I got anything from $12 an hour to $43, $44 an hour, which is, you know, close to 90,000, I believe. I don't have the calculation right in front of me, but that's a huge range. And these came from all over the state. This wasn't necessarily higher wages within a region. Like even in a place like Boulder, I was getting a range from $17 to $38 an hour as what should be the livable wage in Boulder.
The first part of this survey was, is there a labor shortage? What were people saying?
You know, since my column has largely focused on the pandemic unemployment, I was thinking a lot of people would say, no, there's not a labor shortage, or yes, there's a labor shortage. But the majority of people said it's complicated, which to me is really great because that means people are thinking about why, you know, why is it hard to find enough kitchen help for a restaurant? Or why is minimum wage at $12.32 an hour in Colorado? You know, no one can really rent a one-bedroom apartment or two-bedroom apartment and provide for a family. So comments to that, you know, would range from, you know, you shouldn't expect to have a livable wage on minimum wage, to others that were like, well, I can't move up, or these folks are on unemployment, so that's why they're not looking for a job. All the different facets of why it's tough to live in Colorado as the cost of living increases, but there's still a lot of jobs out there.
In this reader poll, there was a space for comments. What were some of the nuances that stood out to you in the responses?
I really loved when people added a little more nuance and insight into it. Some of the common reasons were housing. You know, housing costs have gone way up. And if you think about what happened during the pandemic, you know, the cost of a single family home has just skyrocketed. And trying to even buy a house is nearly impossible unless you have cash and can offer cash and buy it as is and stuff. So when you have that on one end, and then on the other end, you have people who've lost their jobs during the pandemic, these folks are looking at, well, what's available to me? You know, maybe I'm an unskilled worker. Restaurant jobs, you know, $15 to even $20 plus tips, that's still hard to qualify for. Well, probably impossible to qualify for a mortgage, but even for rent, that might be pretty difficult. So I just appreciated the extra thoughts that people included with their responses.
And finally, the pandemic has set the reset button on a lot of aspects of our daily lives. What improvements for the better would you like to see come out of the pandemic on your particular beat?
I think a lot is going to change in the next few months. So at the end of this week, the national eviction moratorium is going to end. So a lot of people who have seen a decline in income, they've been allowed to, you know, sign an attestation saying that they can't afford to pay rent because of a COVID-related reason. So that's ending. And then these folks are going to have to figure out how to pay rent. In early September, the federal unemployment benefits are going to end. So that's going to add another level of complexity for a lot of these people who are still on unemployment and maybe haven't been paying their rent. So, you know, that doesn't mean all these people can go back to work. One person or a few people did bring up, well, there's still COVID and, you know, there's a concern about getting sick on the job. So they're not returning to work for health reasons. There is just many major changes coming with how Americans live, have lived in the pandemic, that will impact our future just within the next month or so. And I'll just be here to cover it. So,
Tamara Chung of the Colorado Sun, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
As the demand to live in Western mountain towns continues to explode, the housing crunch for local workers is more dire than ever. One way several town governments are trying to help is by offering down payment assistance for some of those workers to buy homes. Will Walkie from KHOL reports on how that effort is going in Jackson, Wyoming. The story is part of a Rocky Mountain Community Radio reporting collaboration on affordable housing, funded by the Solutions Journalism Network.
Charlotte DePrisco is an elementary school counselor who grew up in Jackson. At 34, she and her fiancé are looking to buy a home of their own and potentially start a family. But over the past 6 months they've been looking, they haven't been able to find anything they can afford.
We've looked at condos that are $900,000 and they're two-bedroom, one-bath, and they need work. And that's just not feasible for us.
The average sale price of a single-family home in Jackson Hole was about $4.3 million in the first quarter of 2021, according to a recent market report. Katie Brady has been working in Jackson real estate for more than a decade, and she says the local demand for houses has skyrocketed since the second half of 2020.
Properties are getting half dozen to a dozen offers within the first day or so, and a lot of that has to do with the limited inventory.
Brady says there's only a handful of properties under $1 million available in Jackson at any given time. But that's still way too expensive for the majority of area residents, including DePrisco. She's also been looking for options through the Teton County Affordable Housing Department, but that hasn't worked out either.
We make too much money for an affordable housing unit, but we can't afford a free market. So we're stuck in this limbo, this like gray area.
Educators, police officers, and even doctors are struggling to make a life for themselves in Jackson. That's where April Norton comes in.
We've seen households that could afford a $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 monthly payment, but they don't have $100,000 sitting around, and that's been a real barrier for them.
Norton is the first director of Teton County's Affordable Housing Department. This year, she helped launch a preservation program that helps local workers pay a higher down payment on their home so that they can get a more reasonable mortgage. The pilot grants up to $150,000 for every family accepted into the program.
It seems like a win-win for the the folks who want to stay here and live here and own here.
In return for the assistance, Teton County puts a cap on the appreciation value of the home once it's sold, making sure it remains affordable over time. It also establishes a permanent restriction on the property. Whoever lives there must make the majority of their income in Jackson Hole.
The point of that is just to make sure that we're not getting what we love to call modem cowboys coming in and applying for and getting workforce homes. And we really want to provide housing for people who need to be here to do their jobs.
Norton says another benefit is that it helps protect existing housing stock from being redeveloped into mansions. That was part of the inspiration behind the model that Jackson's program is based on in Vail, Colorado.
We've come to grips, at least a long time ago, that we're not going to build our way out of this problem. So we sought to come up with a program that had a focus on protecting and preserving some of those existing dwelling units in the town of Vail.
George Ruther is housing director in Vail, and he helped start a program called Vail Indeed in 2017. Jackson's effort isn't exactly the same, but the general outcome is. And in Vail, it's been really successful.
We spent, like I said, about $11 million on 170 deed restrictions, and we've provided housing for 360 individuals.
Other resort communities, from Breckenridge, Colorado, to lakeside towns in Michigan, have also adopted similar programs. And some early evidence seems to indicate that they're working. 2 years after Vail Indeed began, an economic study found that the town's investment in housing yielded a 5% return for local taxpayers.
It's no different than roads, bridges, schools, fire departments, etc., meaning without housing for our year-round residents and our workforce, Vail isn't a resort community.
Jackson has not yet seen that success. Just three families have used the down payment assistance program thus far. DePrisco applied and was accepted into it, but she says that $150,000 in help just wasn't enough.
I feel like if someone was listening to this that didn't live here and didn't know what it was like, they'd be like, are you serious? But it barely made a dent. Like, that's so sad.
Norton, the Teton County Housing Director, says it's really hard for her department to compete with out-of-towners with cash. That's why she'd like to have more resources akin to Colorado, a higher tax state. Norton does still have about $500,000 at her disposal to help get Jackson Hole's down payment assistance program off the ground. She says it'll just take time. For KHOL News and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Will Walkie.
Time now for Naturally with herbalist Brigitte Mars.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. So we all know by now that getting sunburned is not a cool idea. I know some of you might remember putting baby oil on yourself and tanning with those aluminum things. Yeah, that was so last century. Not cool now. So what are you going to do? Don't fall asleep in the sun. I have to say, I'm not a huge sunscreen wearer. I tend to wear a hat, go out early in the day or later in the afternoon. But I do know that there's a lot of controversy about sunscreens. And because I do work somewhere where we sell natural products, I will say that my preference is to use reef-friendly, mineral-based sunscreens rather than chemical-based sunscreens. And we also want to avoid nanoparticles because they get into your bloodstream, which is not a good idea. So, of course, we want to minimize and be aware of what time we're going out. But it can take up to 4 hours for a sunburn to totally manifest. So if you think you've gotten too much sun, coming in and showering will help minimize the intensity of a burn. Anytime we've gotten too much sun, we want to rehydrate and drink a lot of water. But if we've gotten too much sun and we've done the showering after too much exposure, you might soak in a tepid bath and add a cup of apple cider vinegar or some black tea. So just make up a big pot of black tea on the stove. It could be any kind, but you know, if we're supporting organic, that's always a good idea. And boil up some water, add your tea bags, like maybe a dozen of them, and then add the water to the bath and soak in that. That's going to help prevent you from manifesting too much burn and also help you from blistering. We can also use aloe vera, But a lot of the aloe vera juices in the bottles contain sodium benzoate, which can be a little irritating. So look for a product that's designed for after sun, maybe something with aloe vera and lavender oil. Again, we want to hydrate and eat cooling foods. So if you've gotten too much sun, really hot, spicy food might not be the best thing, but maybe some cucumber soup or some watermelon, some iced peppermint tea. These would be good things to do. St. John's wort oil, also known as hypericum, is also a remedy for burns. So, you know, if you've gotten too much sun, take a break. Don't get any more for a while. Rehydrate and learn your lesson for the next time. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to volunteers Jamie Sudler for headlines production and to Brigitte Mars for her weekly segment, Naturally.